Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and practiced on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. High Truths is more than a podcast. It's a movement to unite physical, mental, and addiction health. It brings innovations to connect public health, public safety, and prevention. Our discussions inspire people to implement programs that save lives. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a 5-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com. Today's episode is sponsored by Drug Free America Foundation, tackling the pervasive issue of substance use and its far-reaching impacts on individuals, families, and community. Drug Free America is supporting ISAC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis, doctors and scientists educating on the harms of marijuana. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for a Delta 8 conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. Delta 8, as in the new version of the THC psychoactive drug. Delta 8, Delta 10, THCOA, THCP are all lab-made psychoactive drugs, similar to the common Delta 9 THC we all know is a key psychoactive component of marijuana. These new group of drugs were born out of Congress's 2018 Farm Bill. Congress defined hemp as anything less than 0.3% dry weight Delta 9 THC. The drug profiteers ran with this definition. Delta 8, Delta 10, any new chemical that had no Delta 9 in it were all technically legal. They're all defined as hemp. They were legal, but they've never been tested, not even in rats. Forget FDA approval. These drugs went straight to the smoke shops and malls using our children as lab rats. These products are all made in a lab. They're not plant-based. Congress may call them hemp, but these products are not farmed. They are synthesized. A child even died getting into his mom's Delta 8 stash. People have been sick and psychotic from using these products. The FDA sent warning labels for products containing Delta 8 THC and the other family of THC drugs. The product remains federally legal, but some states have banned the products. To learn more about Delta 8 and other derived intoxicating cannabis products, I reached out to Dr. Matthew Rosheim. Dr. Matthew Rosheim is an associate professor at the College of Public Health at the University of North Texas Health Science Center. He is one of the nation's leading public health experts on derived intoxicating cannabis products, such as Delta 8 THC. His work includes more than 100 peer-reviewed research manuscripts and scientific presentations that have helped influence the laws and regulation. His research has been cited in reports by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration and World Health Organization, as well as various media. I was at his lecture at the CADCA Forum in D.C., where he spoke with Sue Thau on closing the loophole on hemp products. Everything you wanted to know. I figured you too would want to know everything there is to know about these hemp products, and so I invited him to the show. To learn more about Dr. Matthew Rosheim, check out the High Truth show notes. I recorded this conversation with Dr. Rosheim on February 14th, 2025. Dr. Matt Rosheim, welcome to High Truths.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is awesome. I just saw you at CADCA Forum. We were both speakers. I was there at your lecture, and I thought, I got to have this guy. And so I'm so thankful that you were gracious to do that and get to know you and your research a little better. But you started your career in economics, and somehow you made a connection to public health and then health behavior. Tell us about all that, how that connects.
Yeah, it was kind of by chance. I was a senior at the University of Florida studying economics, and I was really interested in kind of the behavioral economics books like Freakonomics and Nudge and things like that, how things even beyond financial incentives motivate different behaviors. And so just by chance, I ran into a friend from high school who was working on his master's thesis and doing a study out at the bar districts in Gainesville, Florida, where he was interviewing and breath testing exiting bar patrons who were happy to participate for a slice of pizza. And so the first study he was doing really drew my attention. It was a study looking at the price of alcohol in the bars and how heavily intoxicated people were when they were leaving and how much money they spent on each drink. And so we interviewed people about what all they drank that night, how much they spent. And sure enough, as we'd expect, according to just basic economic theory, cheaper alcohol was associated with higher intoxication levels. But what really drew me into public health was...
What a fun project.
Oh, yeah.
Get a breathalyzer and some pizza. Wow, that looks like that's fun research.
Yeah, absolutely. And so what really drew me in was we did a subsequent study using the same data because we asked what all they consumed that night. And this was when Four Loko and Red Bull and vodka and those alcohol energy drinks were really, there was a lot of buzz on college campuses about, you know, consuming alcohol mixed with energy drink. Well, we found that bar patrons who consumed alcohol mixed with energy drink were three times as likely to exit the bars legally intoxicated for driving purposes and four times as likely to intend to drive to their next location. And so this study was actually cited by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration in their letters to the manufacturers of these companies stating that it was an unsafe additive and they couldn't have caffeine in these prepackaged products. And so that's what really got me interested.
Did you understand the chemistry of that? Why would caffeine like increase your alcohol level?
Yeah, so it's hypothesized that it's like mixing an upper and a downer, you know, alcohol having the depressant effect and caffeine having the stimulant effect, that people are consuming more alcohol than they realize. It's keeping them more alert so they can continue drinking even though, you know, they would normally get tired if they got too heavily intoxicated, and then being alert and feeling like they could drive safely.
Oh, so it's not a chemical thing. It's more like an emotional response where you're going to just consume more alcohol.
Yeah, kind of like the physiological effect of being just...
And yet after your hangover, you want to like drink coffee, right? Or
right. Yeah.
Interesting.
So getting to see all of the, you know, learn about the behind the scenes advocacy work that people did, public health organizations did to actually, you know, have that impact on the world around us. I thought that was super cool and decided to continue to pursue then a master's of public health and then a PhD in public health sciences.
Well, that is pretty rewarding when you write a paper and the FDA cites it right away. That's like positive reinforcement. That's amazing. You got like that health behavior in you, right? That shaped your right. career.
Right.
That's amazing. All right. So your lecture at CADCA was Closing the Loophole on Hemp. And I gave our listeners a little bit of preview, but you know, let's hear it from you. Tell us, what is this loophole?
Yeah, so prior to the 2018 Farm Bill, most of the intoxicating cannabis products that were sold in the U.S. almost exclusively were these Delta-9 THC products because it is the most naturally abundant intoxicating compound in the cannabis plant. So what'll get you high? And so basically what they were trying to do in this Farm Bill was to legalize hemp for industrial manufacturing of homes and clothing and things like that. So they defined hemp as anything with a very little bit of Delta-9 THC by weight, so less than or equal to 0.3% by weight.
So if the Farm Bill and the hemp part was to make clothing, textile, not for food.
Yeah, when people were championing this, they said it was rope, not dope. That's what the catchphrase was that helped push this forward. And so
famous last words.
Exactly. But that's not what they did. And so what has happened is we've identified now dozens of different intoxicating cannabinoids that are being chemically created and being added to either food or beverage in vape liquid or sprayed on hemp flower and being sold. And so one of the studies that we recently published was basically identifying that in the past decade in the U.S., the cannabis retail has been the most drastically changed market in that prior to 2014, you couldn't legally buy it anywhere. Since then, half of states have passed laws that have legalized it. And in most of those states and in all the states where it's not sold legally in dispensaries, they're selling these intoxicating cannabinoids that are either derived from hemp or the Delta-9 edibles. That's another loophole as well, because the weight of food and beverage just weighs so much that they can just add a very, what they're doing is adding a very high dose of regular Delta-9 THC and then calling the end product hemp.
Wait, okay, so let's talk about that, because in your lecture you said something fascinating. So the definition of hemp, according to the 2018 Farm Bill, is less than 0.3% dry weight Delta-9 THC. So then that loophole was like, oh, well, we got Delta-8, Delta-10, we have all these other things. But what is 0.3% dry weight? What does that mean?
Yeah, so how the retailers are interpreting it is whatever the weight of their final good, the final product that they're selling is, as long as that is no more than 0.3% of that weight is Delta-9 THC, which if a product weighs, you know, a pound, that could be a massive dose of just regular Delta-9 THC. And they're claiming that this is hemp and federally legal, although there are other laws that would suggest that it's not. Things like, you know, the FDA has stated that THC is not a approved or safe, generally recognized as safe food additive, as well as there's the Federal Analog Act as well that states that if, you know, chemicals have similar effects to things that are listed as Schedule I substances, that they're illegal as well. However, these retailers have just been looking at the Federal Farm Bill and stating that, you know, according to this law by itself, these products are legal.
Okay, Matt, do the math for me. What does that 0.3% dry weight THC mean?
Sure. So a muffin that weighs on average about 85 grams, 0.3% of that would be 255 milligrams. So what people are doing is adding up to 255 milligrams of regular Delta-9 THC, putting it in a muffin and calling it hemp.
So legal hemp could kill you, according to that definition.
It is a very, very high dose. Yeah, you could experience some severe medical issues, you know, mental health problems, psychoses.
I think that would take you to the ER, right? I mean, unless you have that tolerance. Because, you know, states have regulated edibles with definitions of like 5 or 10 per dose or 100 per package. So this is, you know, more than twice that.
Exactly.
Wow. Okay, so that's dry weight. But what about the drinks and the tinctures and liquids? Does that mean you can have infinity, or what they're actually selling? Because it's not dry weight, it's wet weight. And that's the part I didn't understand.
That's interesting as well that you bring that up. It's not especially clear. Some of the beverages that are being commonly sold now tend to have lower doses, about 5 to 10 milligrams per container. But a big issue with those are related to co-use. A lot of them are sold in places that also sell alcohol. The marketing of them in terms of, you know, a non-alcoholic alternative. But, you know, co-use of alcohol and cannabis is already very common, especially among young people, and is the most common combination of substances involved in fatal traffic crashes. And so there's concerns about using the products together.
Right. So I think Congress realized that they kind of screwed up in the 2018 Farm Bill, and they had at it again in 2024 and made some changes, right? They took out the Delta-9 and said, okay, any type of THC total. But then they still kept it at 0.3% dry weight. So did that fix things in any way?
Well, we'll see if that actually gets signed into law. So yeah, what you're referring to is the Merriam-Miller Amendment, which we very much support because it would help close this federal loophole. But they have until September 30th for that to be signed into law.
And is that dry weight definition still good, or because that still would allow you 255 milligrams per muffin?
Yeah, really the way to close this loophole is for any detectable amount of these intoxicating cannabinoids. And the Merriam-Miller Amendment, it's relatively lengthy, but it does a great job in terms of helping close this loophole, even for things that aren't THC. So some of these compounds like HHC are chemically different, but still mimic the effect of THC.
Or go back to what they said they wanted to do. You could have, I don't care, 10% in your rope and 0% in your in your food. It is interesting. Especially it'll be interesting to watch what happens now with RFK, really looking at the food supply. And I see that part of the food supply that is not regulated. So that'll be interesting if marijuana gets a pass on that or not. Definitions. Okay. You call it in your articles, you call it intoxicating derived cannabis. And I think you mean these Delta products, right? The Delta 8, the 10s. I've seen that also called semi-synthetic products. We've been struggling with a definition of that. Is there – we all say Delta 8 products. I think we know what we mean. What's your vibe on the definitions?
Yeah, this has been part of the challenge because however laws are crafted to try to capture all of this class of products that have emerged, it seems like the industry comes out with a new chemical solution to circumvent how we're defining and describing. So part of that challenge is by design. You know, if we crack down on THC, then it's HHC, or if it's any intoxicating cannabinoids, then it's THCA, which is a chemical precursor. It's not intoxicating until you heat it. And so, or if it's the semi-synthetics, then they just go to the edibles that are regular Delta 9 edibles. And so that's been part of the challenge is what do we call all these things so that the industry can't just come up with a work, a simple workaround. The terminology that we've landed on recently is referring to these as derived intoxicating cannabis products. In part to help distinguish them from CBD, which is, a cannabinoid, but non-intoxicating, doesn't give you that same high, but still has some psychoactive effects.
Okay, so intoxicating cannabis product derived. Derived mean that it's not plant-based, right?
Correct, chemically created.
And intoxicating means it's not CBD. So does that include the high-potency THC Delta 9 products that are out there?
So that's a great question. It depends. It depends if it's from naturally grown, cannabis plant or if it's chemically created. So it's possible that people are
at the end of the day, you have like a 99% shatter. Some lab involved in that somehow.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's a major issue as well. The proliferation of very high potency products, the average THC content, even in legal markets nowadays, is five times what it was in DEA seized products 30 years ago is the average. And as you mentioned, the concentrates now, the average is like 60% in some products in the 90-something percent THC. And so, in terms of all of the harms, it's a dose response, effect that the higher, dose that people put in, the greater the odds of experiencing all of these negative consequences. Mental health problems, addiction, the cognitive impairment, smoking, respiratory effects, right? Things like that.
Yeah, definitely. Okay. Conclusion is when you're talking about and in your research about derived intoxicating cannabis products, you're referring to all the new kind of products, but not Delta 9 so much and not CBD?
Correct. Yes. Assuming that the Delta 9 is just naturally grown and not chemically created.
Right. And that's the tricky part.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I think a lot of those things are still made in a lab, but, even if they say that they aren't. All right. So you're doing your research on intoxicating derived cannabis. Are you going undercover like you did in in the bars and getting pizza to people who are getting drunk? Or when you go and buy things and do that research?
Kind of, yeah. So it's really interesting work. So I've gone into a number of stores and looked at the products that they're selling, and even bought some and ordered some online, and also have conducted numerous phone calls. In the one study, I called 520 vape shops across the U.S. and contacted them and asked them about all the different types of products that they were selling and even analyzed them by different state laws. And that's one of the ways that we know that state bans have really been effective, too, in terms of reducing the availability of these intoxicating cannabis products.
Yeah.
One of the interesting findings from that study was that regulations were not. So there was a number of states that tried to limit the availability of these products, either by, you know, having a low cap on the THC content or by outright regulating the retail availability. However, those laws were not at all associated with reduced availability, even though that was their intent, because of exactly what we saw, which was selling new types of these products to circumvent those regulations.
Wait, is that the whole whack-a-mole idea? You've banned this, so we just created a different one?
Exactly.
Okay, instead of having an... So which type of regulation that were meant to curb this market work the best? Which states are good examples?
Yeah, so states that had bans on the sale of all of these products. So in our study, compared to states that had bans, those in states without bans had 16 times the odds of those vape shops selling these intoxicating cannabis products.
Yeah.
And that's even after adjusting for other important confounders like active retail in licensed dispensaries in the states.
So there are other things that you kind of research as far as availability, price, ages, besides banning the products. And what else did you find out about what's out there?
Yeah, so there's just a lot of concerning marketing practices in terms of these products that are available. In addition to the high potency products, the packaging of the products, they have cartoon characters and sometimes even trademark infringed products. So this is a bag of Cheetos that I grabbed from my cafeteria at lunch right across the street here. And then this is one that I ordered online that has, as you can see on the bottom, 600 milligrams of THC in this little bag, which at, 5 milligrams per serving, that's 120 servings of.
So aren't the Cheetos people angry at this?
I think that they should be. Yeah, that it's
clearly
trademark infringed, but. That's not even the half of it. I mean, they have, chocolate bars and, Rice Krispie treats and all sorts of other different products that have.
So are you going in these stores with like your hoodie and jeans and.
Exactly. Yeah. This one was really interesting. So this was right after the DEA issued the letter that THCO is clearly federally illegal.
Yeah.
And so I asked them about this. I was like, isn't that illegal now? And they were like, oh yeah, it's BOGO because they're illegal now. So, yeah.
Okay. So you must have some really interesting conversations as you're doing your research. Can tell us some of these conversations that you're having with people.
So it looks different in different stores. So, these specialty stores, the vape shops or smoke shops that are selling these products that have just hundreds of different types of these products, everything from flower, regular flower and vapes to all these different edibles and things like that, and the concentrates. And they tend to be more highly knowledgeable about the products, but they have just a wide range of products, very inexpensive, sometimes gummies that are like $2 or $3. They seem to have the ones that are also like very youth oriented in terms of the packaging and things like that. And they sell a lot of blends in those stores. And so there are oftentimes, we know very little about the health effects. There's almost no data on the human health effects of any of these new intoxicating cannabinoids in and of themselves, but they'll sell products with 2 to oftentimes 8 different intoxicating cannabinoids in a single product, in a vape or in an edible. And so, we just don't know. We just don't have the information about what that's going to do. And we've noted even in the online studies that, the majority of products being sold now are these blends. And we've noted hundreds of different combinations of them. So from an epidemiological perspective, it's really concerning, because if there's an outbreak, getting to like the source of the outbreak, like what the chemical compounds and modalities and other interactions with other ingredients is very tricky. The other thing that's really interesting about these stores, like in Texas, for example, we don't have legalized non-medical cannabis. We have a very restricted medical system, but these stores are very like open in terms of on 420, they'll hold events where they'll let you, they'll give out free gummies for you to eat right there or hit bongs in the store,
Do they tell you not to drive? Like if you drove in there and now you had a gummy, now you're going to drive home and crash?
That's a great question. Yeah, it's very, very irresponsible to be having people smoke, vaping and smoking flower in the stores and eating edibles and things like that. But it's like an event that some of them will have like a DJ and food trucks and things like that and have giveaways. And to the contrary, what's another type of environment where these are commonly sold is just the neighborhood gas station convenience stores. And so oftentimes they'll have like usually cake brand Delta 8 or Delta 10 vapes, and not very knowledgeable about it. So some of them that I talk to, you know, I ask them if they have any THC products and they'll say no. And then I'll ask about Delta 8 and they'll say, oh yeah, we've got Delta 8 vapes. And when we ask them about like, what is that? They'll liken it to like CBD or hemp or other non-intoxicating things. So there's concerns about both environments in terms of.
So they don't really know what they're selling, right? It's like, well, I don't know. These are cigarettes and there's some Delta 8s, you know?
Exactly. Yeah.
Wow. And have they been, like, if you went in there and do you ever say like, hey, what do you recommend for my psoriasis or something? Do you have?
We haven't asked that in particular. We've asked about popular brands to try to kind of narrow down and see which ones to focus on. Yeah. Brand level work is really important because we know, for example, in alcohol, there's 10,000 different alcohol brands, but you know, 25 of those brands represent more than half of the alcohol consumed by underage drinkers. Same thing with, as we've seen with like Juul and the e-cigarette epidemic, like just understanding, you know, the products that are being used. Right now, it seems to be a very fragmented market with a lot of, you know, different brands having substantial market share. But in terms of that, as you mentioned, the marketing in terms of like health effects, we see that online, especially when we look at the product descriptions. We've done studies and it seems that you know, these are marketed for all sorts of different, from pain relief to sleep aid and all sorts of unsubstantiated claims that are being marketed about, you know, the potential benefits or health benefits or, you know.
And that's flat out illegal, but it's not policed.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, beyond that, even claims about safety, how these products are being marketed as natural or organic or things like that, which is just ridiculous considering how they're chemically created and all the different chemical byproducts. And so they're simultaneously, you know, using these wording to make it sound very like safe and healthy and natural. And at the same time, being very deceptive and misleading with regard to what's actually in the products. We've seen that with the certificates of analysis. And so a lot of these products will have on them a something like a scan for certificate of analysis, a QR code on them that you can scan. What some studies have done is they've looked at those lab reports and they've independently tested the products. And what they've found is that the lab reports online oftentimes, very oftentimes, do not match up with what's actually in the products. And so sometimes they'll have regular Delta 9 THC limits that are much higher to the extent that these products would clearly be federally illegal. And other times it's things like they're missing information about chemical contaminants, things like heavy metals or mold or things like that that are dangerous. And so there's been.
So they don't include that in the report. In a, you know, in your legal, even medical dispensary, when they have a certificate and, you know, they're very proud of that, it may or may not be accurate, but they have no obligation to tell you about the heavy metals or the mold, right? They're just going to tell you about their percent THC and CBD.
Yeah. So for these products, because they fit in this kind of legal gray area, there's no federal, almost no federal regulation, right? The FTC should be very interested in cracking down on things like deceptive marketing claims and things like that. But yes, they're just reporting what they decide to. And so there, it's the guise of corporate social responsibility that they're saying, look, we're, you know, educating consumers and being transparent while at the same time providing information that's misleading, you know, gives a false sense of security when their products are more hazardous than they're leading on. And there's even been reports of companies shopping around for labs and, you know, legitimate labs struggling with business because they're looking for places that are going to, you know, be willing to change the THC content how they like it and to not report any of these other, you know, contaminants.
That's amazing that you know that. I did a podcast with one of these legit lab guys, Josh Swider, and he says, yeah, he knows these companies, they could go find a lab to tell them what they want to hear. Yeah, it is kind of scary. And I don't think people even understand that. What about I think it's just a matter of time. We saw the outrage on Joe Camel, you know, selling to kids. Well, we've got, like you said, cartoon characters. You know, that marketing, that is that targeted to youth and to alter their perception of harm of these products?
Absolutely. I mean, that's what the major findings that led to the whole thing with cigarettes, you know, in their advertising was it was found to be appealing to and largely recognized by young people. And, you know, the brands that were doing that had large market share among kids. And so, you know, we decided this decades ago that that wasn't acceptable. And yet now today we've got these products being sold with, you know, cartoon characters on tons of them and marketed in ways that would be illegal for other substances. It's just incredible that it's the same companies who are lobbying to not be banned federally and in states, saying that these are responsible companies and that this is an adult use product, and yet they're slapping cartoon characters on their products. It's just insane.
What is that, like that Cheetah, what does that cost? Is that expensive?
I don't remember the cost of that one specifically. I think that one was more expensive in general than most of the ones that I've purchased, but I've been able to purchase gummies with up to 100 milligrams of THC for just like $3. So these products are very inexpensive. We've done some research as well, looking at the geographic retail availability of these. And concerningly, we found that they're disproportionately located in low-income communities, as well as we just published another study showing that in Fort Worth, Texas, stores that were closer to schools had higher odds of selling these products.
Yeah, that's very sad. Any difference between the shops? You kind of gave us a difference between the, you know, the gas station shops versus the nice fancy Apple store, I call them. It looks like the Apple store inside versus online. Is there anything that your research let's show, like who's buying online or products or anything else that's different?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's important to note that the online retail availability has very weak age regulations as well. So there have been a couple of studies now that have looked at the age verification processes. And even when I've purchased some, you know, it's very, very weak self-reported age verification. It just shows up in your mailbox. There are other places that sell these products as well. So one thing that we've seen is vending machines. You know, places where people can not even, you know, deal with the online platform or an in-store retailer. And that was, you know, pretty close to a college campus where we saw that, as well as, you know, one thing concerning about states that have legalized is not only the dispensaries tend to be more kind of, regulated environment, but many states, I think at least 12 states now, have on-site consumption lounges that are similar to bars, but it's a place that you can use cannabis there. And when you raise the question about like driving after and things like that.
Yeah, you'd think that there'd be like a poster and a bunch of Uber drivers like waiting to pick you up if you're going to do it safely.
Absolutely, because we know that it could take a very long time for, you know, to sober up that, especially when people are using indoors and you're not sure about dosing. You can get secondhand high just from all of the people smoking and vaping around you and things like that. So definitely has major concerns regarding that as well.
Yeah. And so we're talking about cannabis, but I'm wondering when you're, you know, buying stuff, have you noticed all the new psychedelics out there and the mushrooms and also cartoony mushrooms? And we've had some of our prevention specialists buy those products and get those tested and found, again, psilocybin or THC or nothing or bath salts. You know, that goes along with these same, you know, I'm wondering if the same thing. It's like, okay, we can't do Delta 8. We'll just do these psychedelics.
Absolutely. Yeah. So especially in the vape and smoke shops. When I contacted those 520 smoke shops across the US, it was disproportionately in large cities. So it was stores near the Capitol building or the largest commercial airport in each state. And when I talked to them, 74% of them sold some sort of intoxicating cannabis product. So almost three-fourths of smoke shops.
What's that conversation like? You're calling up a shop and tell us what's that like? Hi, my name is Dr. Rosheim. I'm wondering what you're selling, or how does that go?
No, I don't think any of them would have answered me if I said that. So I just called up and said, hey, do you all have any Delta 8 products? You know, what about Delta 10, HHC, THCA, THCO? I also asked about popular brands that they sold and about Kratom. And so interestingly, 72% of these vape shops sold Kratom as well. And if you're not familiar with what that is, it can have, it's marketed as having both potentially stimulant or sedative type effects, depending on the dosage. It's concerning because it is a highly, you know, addictive substance as well, and can have a variety of different negative health effects, liver problems and seizures and contamination with salmonella and things like that. And so the fact that it's so widespread across the nation as well is, you know, these smoke shops seem to be, the niche they seem to be filling is for these under-regulated substances that there's not really, you know, any strong federal regulations on, you know, what all can be sold. And when places in states that had bans, or in places that, you know, either weren't allowed to sell them or just didn't have these products, oftentimes they would bring it up. They'd say, no, you know, we're not allowed to sell that, but we do, they'd offer up, we do have, you know, mushrooms. They don't have psilocybin, so they're not illegal, but, you know, they're definitely make you trip. So come on in and check those out. So they were definitely advertising other substances as well.
That's interesting. That's a lot of interesting conversations that you had. You did a study on the perception of young people to these products. What did you find on that?
Yeah, concerningly, a lot of young adults view these products as being regulated and as safe, you know, to use, despite the you know, the fact that they're not regulated by the FDA and they're not safety standards. The majority of young adults thought that there were for these products.
They look legit, right? The building looks legit. The packaging looks legit. Did your study look at, and I'm sure we've done this already. This is like our second or third rodeo, right? We've done this with tobacco. We've learned that, you know, the marketing does make a difference and the packaging does make a difference and the warning signs, even to the font and the color, makes a difference. But you're just having to like prove all this again. And are you finding the same results? Like, does the packaging make the perception less? I don't know if you went to that type of detail in your research.
Yeah. So in general, we know that a few things really matter when it comes to population level use, and especially use among young people: the retail availability, how available the substances are to them, how they're advertised, and the price points. And based on everything we've learned from all the studies on alcohol, tobacco, and even just regular cannabis products, this is why I largely transitioned from studying alcohol to studying these products, is that this is just the wild west of all of those. Like you said, we're back to square one with having, you know, basically no regulations for the protection of public health, safety, youth prevention, things like that. And so, yes, it's all of the most egregious marketing practices that we could know about all wrapped into, you know, these products.
Yeah, the wild, wild west. And this is an American problem, right? You don't see other parts of the world selling these kind of candies or whatever, right? I just, you know, they've done major studies on psychosis and cannabis out of Europe. But when you talk to them, it's like low level THC. And I ask them, do you have all these edibles and candies and shatters and dabs? And they don't even have that.
Yeah, no, this largely came to rise in the U.S. It spilled over a little bit into other countries with some of these derived products, but it's largely because of the language in the 2018 Farm Bill, which retailers have really exploited in claiming that these products are legal.
Yeah, that's terrible. All right, I want to read you a phrase in one of your publications. Here's like a trick question, and you tell me what the product is, okay? So here it goes. It costs $323 billion a year, causes cancer, poisoning, injuries, violence, crime, social, legal, and mental health problems. I'm kind of paraphrasing. Consequences by people around people who use this product include intimate partner violence, traffic injuries, child neglect, broader social economic burdens. Okay, what is that drug?
Alcohol.
Yeah, I knew. Well, you wrote the article, so of course you know the answer. But it's like you could take that phraseology and apply it to any of these products.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, and so that's one of the major concerns with, you know, states that have tried to regulate their way out of this issue is that, you know, the vast majority of public health harm when it comes to substances are these legal regulated substances. Most people don't recognize that alcohol, for example, costs about a third of $1 trillion annually in the U.S. from all of the negative associated harms with it.
Right. But we didn't do the math for the cannabis products, have we?
Yeah, not that I know of, especially not for these derived products. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I would say that same problem exists with the cannabis products. And we just, I mean, alcohol's been a lot longer than that. But we should be doing the same math. You had a research project on the evolving alcohol landscape. What is that like? There's a competition now between, you know, some people say that cannabis has now beaten the market share for over alcohol. So what is
it? Yeah. Yeah. So there's been a lot of changes in the alcohol retail market as well in recent years that raise major concerns with regard to promoting heavy alcohol consumption, as well as promoting, you know, access and availability and consumption among especially young people. So we've seen an explosion in the last decade of the variety and the alcohol by volume or strength of ready to drink products. So I'm sure you've seen the hard seltzers, hard sodas, hard tea, hard lemonade, all of these hard products that have hit the market in gas station convenience stores, grocery stores, the type of stores that underage young people have access to. And these are the types of products that they disproportionately consume are these sugar sweetened flavored alcoholic beverages. And so in terms of,
is that like the Trulies or the?
Yeah. So those are popular among young people, the, you know, the White Claws and Trulies and things like that. And so these products, you know, are marketed in a way that is appealing to young people, including issues with co-branding. And so like the Jack and Coke now in a can with Coca-Cola and the Hard Mountain Dew and things like that, where alcohol companies are discouraged from promoting their brands to underage audiences. And yet, you know, Coca-Cola and Pepsi are, you know, one of the biggest sponsors of sports events. And, you know, they are everywhere. And then they can just make a hard version and put alcohol in it. And in some stores, put it, you know, very close to the other products. And so there's major issues with co-branding and capitalizing on brand loyalty. But also just this beyond that, this product class, we know that underage young people disproportionately consume these. The alcohol content of these products has risen over time. A lot of them started with 5% and have transitioned to 8%. And now some companies are pushing the limit at 12, 14, and now with Fireball, 16.5% alcohol by volume in their ready to drink products.
And that's legal.
Yeah. So in a lot of states, that's able to be sold in like gas station convenience type stores, the types of stores that underage young people are most often to obtain alcohol from. Yeah, wow. And they even state on their website that that's why they have it at this level is because it's right underneath like the 17% in a lot of states, the limit. So they're really, wow, really pushing the limit there. Other things related to the alcohol market have to do with the prices of these products. And so these high alcohol by volume, ready to drink ones are very inexpensive as well. So on, you know, underage young people's limited disposable incomes, they can purchase large quantities of sugar sweetened alcohol for very little disposable income. You know, two cans of Four Loko are often sold for $7, and that could be 11 standard alcoholic drinks. And so for just $7, you know, it's very easy to, you know, portably consume two of these cans. And, you know, that's enough
and for a
binge drink right there. Yeah, absolutely. Especially for young people who have low tolerance. And so We've seen disproportionate consumption of these products among young people. We did a couple of studies that showed for we call them supersized Alcopops because they have a lot of alcohol.
Yeah, so I saw that. What is a supersized and what's an alcohol pop?
Yeah, so the Alcopops are like a combination between alcohol and pop. So they have the more sugar sweetened flavors. They've largely been critiqued for being transitional products that help underage young people transition from drinking, you know, soda or other sugar sweetened beverages, energy drinks, to drinking alcohol because it masks the bitter taste of the alcohol. And these supersized ones, they have a ton of alcohol in just one single container. Sometimes as much as almost a 6-pack of beer in just one can. And so we've seen disproportionate calls to U.S. poison control centers for underage drinkers for these products specifically. So over the last decade, disproportionately way more calls for underage drinkers for these products compared to all other alcohol products. As well as we did a study where we looked at legal cases involving these alcohol products in sexual assault cases. And we found that compared to beer products, these supersized Alcopops were disproportionately involved in sexual assault cases that involved minors, so children 17 and younger.
Wow, the new date rape drug?
Yeah, I mean, it's a misleading amount of alcohol in a sugar-sweetened beverage that doesn't taste at all like alcohol. And so it does seem like it's being used as a tool in the sexual victimization of minors.
Wow.
You know, in 95% of cases, it was given from the perpetrator of the crime to the minor.
All right. So you've studied both alcohol and cannabis and the semi-synthetics or intoxicating cannabis products. I'm sure you're asked the classic question. So what's better? Isn't alcohol better than marijuana or worse? Isn't worse? I say better, sorry.
Yeah, that's kind of the harm reduction approach of like, which would be better? The unfortunate truth is that a lot of people are using both, right? And so they're not necessarily being used as substitute goods, but as complementary goods that especially young people are using both products. Part of the issue too has been, there's been a recent proliferation of high quality, inexpensive fake IDs that are readily available online. Which there are major issues with that as well. They can be hard to detect. And so, you know, as a society, we tend to say that, you know, at least not for the young people, but it's been getting harder and harder to be able to actually enforce that. So that's a major issue.
So I think the economics of it is we have numbers on that alcohol and the cigarettes, but we don't have real numbers on the cannabis. So, you know, something that we need to do. As a physician, I say, and you tell me if this sounds like a good argument or not, but I explain the difference. First of all, I wouldn't want colon cancer or breast cancer, right? I don't want either one of those as far as problems to compare issues. But if you drink alcohol, the alcohol is water soluble. So you may get drunk, but you won't get psychosis or kill your liver right away. But with marijuana, a fat soluble molecule, and the fattest part of your body is your brain, you could, just by using it once, have psychosis and affect your mental health for the rest of your life while you're young. So it's very different. And in that sense, alcohol is safer in that age group than marijuana. Although, you know, assaulting your brain is not good with any type of drug.
Yeah, that's true. There's also for alcohol, though, you know, thousands of overdose deaths as well, and so it's neither are good. They both cause a lot of harm, and so I'd be hesitant to put one over the other. But yeah, I see.
Yeah, and the combination. I like your point about the combination. And then we're not counting right now. I mean, only this year did we start even having a code for cannabis hyperemesis syndrome in emergency departments, even though that's been going on for more than 10 years. So we're just not collecting the data on the cannabis harms like we are for these other products.
Absolutely. And I really enjoyed the presentation at the CADCA conference as well. It's not pot talking about the 10 different, you know, typical patients that you see in the hospital ER.
Oh, you came to so we saw each other's presentations.
Yes. Yeah.
That's very cool. Well, thank you. Other drugs, just to speak about other drugs, you talked about, I thought this was a very interesting study you did about e-cigarettes. before and after the flavor banning. I mean, I was rolling my eyes when they were like banning the flavored cigarettes, because I was like, you're banning flavored cigarettes while you have all these candy cannabis stuff. Like, why shouldn't that apply? The same law should apply to cannabis, not just to cigarettes. But you found some good things in that law.
Yeah, absolutely. So we used data before and after the flavored cigarette ban that was part of the U.S. Family Smoking and Prevention and Tobacco Control Act in, I believe it was 2009, on smoking, the odds of smoking among people of different age groups. And so we modeled trends before that and after it, and found that it was that banning flavors in cigarettes was associated with a statistically significant and meaningfully large reduction in the odds of both adolescents and young adults smoking. But that wasn't the case for the older adults. We used them as the kind of comparison group. So compared to, you know, older adults, there was this reduction specifically among young people in smoking. And this is consistent with what we would, you know, theoretically expect based on, you know, their preference for flavors and the role in initiation and things like that. But it was very interesting to see that there was a large reduction in smoking following this.
Yeah, that is interesting. Although I think that we've learned so much on tobacco, we should apply the same thing to other harmful substances that are popping up. Kratom, you said that in your smoke shop survey that it was widely available. Even though it's legal in some areas, not in others, is it safe? Is it something that should go through FDA?
This is really challenging. And I think this speaks to the kind of bigger picture in thinking about, you know, how effective regulations have been in the past and the pitfalls that we've had, especially when it comes to creating a powerful industry. And so, you know, we could on paper write down, you know, everything we know in terms of meaningful regulations that would help, you know, prevent young people from using it, and, you know, minimize related harms and help educate the public about health effects. But the truth of the scenario is it's a constant battle with whether it's alcohol, tobacco, cannabis. We've got these multi-billion-dollar industries who spend tens of millions of dollars annually in lobbying for exactly the opposite, for laws that are directly opposed to the best interest of, you know, society and public health and safety, because they want more people to be consuming their product and for people to be addicted to their products. And so it's a challenging question to answer at this time, because, you know, we know what would be effective in helping regulate this, but it's just an ongoing battle to get those in place and keep them in place.
I don't know why it's a challenge for a public health expert to say something. Like, we have standards on what we eat and consume, whether it's medications that go through FDA or even vitamins and some of the herbal supplements. There are, you know, gold standards in testing and verifications of what we buy. Why should these group of products get a pass on everything else that we consume that we expect to be safe?
Absolutely. Yeah. Ideally, they shouldn't be sold until they have those clinical studies demonstrating their efficacy for what they're being marketed for, as well as for what are the health effects of this, and study it in a clinical control trial.
Yeah. And warning labels, right? You can't watch a, you know, commercial on TV for any new medications and go through all the little warnings that they're there. I did a interesting podcast, you may be interested in this, with a class action lawyer going through some of these products that were drinks that were sold that had kratom in it, and they didn't list that it was there. Just, it's supposed to be a natural drink. And this guy was had an alcohol use disorder, got over, now was sober, and this was sold as, you know, not alcohol, good for alcoholics, and became addicted, where he's buying cases and cases of these things and really seriously affected his mental health. And he went after the 7-Elevens. They stopped selling these products and went after them again for, you know, consumer protections. Consumers should know, right? The whole point of the FDA, right? Food and Drug Administration, is for us to know what we're consuming.
Absolutely.
So you take your research, and it's the best research ever, because you take it and it has immediate, you know, potential solutions in laws and regulations. It's not just a study for study. That's what's so, you know, and what I like so much about your research. And you turn that into working on prevention work. So tell me how that works.
Yeah, thank you so much. I really appreciate that. It's absolutely, the goal is to not just have it, you know, be a paper that sits in a journal, but to take it in and have communities be able to apply it in advocating for laws that help protect public health and safety. And so I've been very fortunate to have the opportunity to work with various organizations at the federal level, state level, and even at the local level, in helping them understand, you know, what's going on nationally, helping them assess local conditions, do some local data collection, and figure out what's going on in their communities, and help communicate that to lawmakers in a way that will shape laws that help protect either from the local conditions to what we need federally. And so I've been very fortunate to have a lot of opportunities to work with a lot of great folks throughout the United States on related advocacy work.
Yeah. And any good tips that you have for people working on prevention?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there are a few really important things that come to mind. One is that my favorite thing about advocacy is it's a team sport. And so building a strong team to help address these issues together, and being able to look at these issues from a variety of perspectives. Another one is just understanding the mission. So figuring out, doing local assessments on not just the retail products and the four P's, but also what laws are specifically need to be changed, and what those, you know, what are the deal breakers in terms of those laws. And then finally, how do you package all of that to tell your story, to make a persuasive case for your lawmakers and in your community to gain support for those initiatives.
Great. And probably people can do on a smaller scale research like you're doing in a community level and use that data in their advocacy.
Absolutely. Yeah. Retail assessments, talking about the products that are available and telling those stories. And especially when these stories come from young people, we found are especially compelling. Being able to say that, you know, these are the products that are sold in my community. They're marketed to me. They're sold in the store right next to our school, where we all go to get, you know, snacks and chips and things like that. And it's high school kids selling it to other high school kids. I think those make some really compelling cases for these changes.
Yeah, that's a great tip. Using the kids, that's a great thing. And what are you working on now? Anything?
Yes, lots of studies in the work, doing some legal epi work, looking at state laws related to these products to help be able to provide more specific guidance, and also match that to additional retail surveillance studies where we're looking at what products are available in different states, especially as state laws change and hopefully this federal law changes. And just continuing to help folks better advocate for stronger laws.
Dr. Matt Rosheim, incredible research to action. And I really can see that economics in you, as well as the public health. And it's a wonderful blend that you kind of, you know, applying in your career. Thank you so much for joining.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to Drug Free America Foundation. Visit dfaf.org. And ISAC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis. That's IASIC1.org. High Truth's producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.